This is Audible.
Random House Audiobooks presents Death in Holy Orders by P.D. James, narrated by Charles Keating.
Book 1, The Killing Sand. 1. It was Father Martin's idea that I should write an account of how I found the body. I asked, "You mean as if I were writing a letter, telling it to a friend?" Father Martin said, "Writing it down as if it were fiction. As if you were standing outside yourself, watching it happen, remembering what you did, what you felt, as if it were all happening to someone else." I knew what he meant, but I wasn't sure I knew where to begin. I said, "Everything that happened, Father? Or just that walk along the beach uncovering Ronald's body?" "Anything and everything you want to say. Write about the college and about your life here, if you like. I think you might find it helpful." "Did you find it helpful, Father?" I don't know why I spoke these words. They just came into my mind and I let them out. It was silly, really, and in a way it was impertinent, but he didn't seem to mind. After a pause, he said, "No, it didn't really help me. But then it was all a very long time ago. I think it might be different for you." I suppose he was thinking about the war and being taken prisoner by the Japanese, the awful events that happened in the camp. He never speaks about the war, but then why should he do so to me? But I don't think he speaks to anyone, not even to the other priests. This conversation happened 2 days ago, when we were walking together through the cloisters after evensong. I don't go to Mass anymore, not since Charlie died, but I do go to evensong. It's a matter of courtesy, really. It doesn't seem right working at the college, taking money from them, accepting all their kindness and never attending any of the services in the church. But perhaps I'm being too sensitive. Mr. Gregory lives in one of the cottages, as I do, and teaches Greek part-time. But he never attends church except when there is music he wants to hear. No one ever presses me to attend. They never even asked why I stopped coming to Mass. But of course they noticed. They notice everything. When I got back to my cottage, I thought about what Father Martin had said and whether perhaps it might not be a good idea. I've never had any difficulty about writing. At school I was good at composition, and Miss Allison, who taught us English, said she thought I might have the talent to be a writer. But I knew that she was wrong. I haven't any imagination. Not the kind novelists need. I can't make things up. I can only write about what I see and do and know, and sometimes what I feel, which isn't as easy. Anyway, I always wanted to be a nurse, even from childhood. I'm 64 and retired now, but I still keep my hand in here at St. Anselm's. I'm partly the matron, dealing with minor illnesses, and I also look after the linen. It's an easy job, but I've got a weak heart and I'm lucky to be working. The college make it as easy as possible for me. They've even provided a lightweight trolley so that I'm not tempted to carry heavy bundles of linen. I ought to have said all this before, and I haven't even written down my name. It's Munro. Margaret Munro. I think I know why Father Martin suggested it would be helpful if I began writing again. He knows that I used to write a long letter to Charlie every week. I think he's the only person here except Ruby Pilbeam who does know that. Every week I'd sit down and remember what had happened since the last letter. The small, unimportant things which wouldn't be unimportant to Charlie. The meals I ate, the jokes I heard, stories about the students, descriptions of the weather. You wouldn't think there would be much to tell in a quiet place like this on the edge of the cliffs, remote from anywhere, but it was surprising what I found to write to him. And I know Charlie loved the letters. "Keep on writing, Mum," he would say when he was home on leave. And I did. After he was killed, the army sent me back all his belongings, and there was the bundle of letters among them. Not everyone I'd written, he couldn't have kept them all, but he did keep some of the longest. I took them onto the headland and made a bonfire. It was a windy day, as it often is on the East Coast, and the flames roared and spat and changed direction with the wind. The charred pieces of paper rose and whirled about my face like black moths, and the smoke stung my nose. It was odd, because it was only a little fire. But what I'm trying to say is that I know why Father Martin suggested I should write this account. He thought that writing something, anything, might help to bring me back to life. He's a good man. Perhaps he's even a holy man. But there's so much he doesn't understand. It seems strange to be writing this account without knowing who, if anyone, will ever see it. And I'm not sure whether I'm writing for myself or for some imaginary reader to whom everything about St. Anselm's will be new and strange. So perhaps I ought to write something about the college, to set the scene, as it were. It was founded in 1861 by a pious lady called Miss Agnes Arbuthnot, who wanted to ensure that there would always be devout and learned young men ordained to the Catholic priesthood in the Church of England. I've put in the inverted commas because those are her words. There's a booklet about her in the church, and that's how I know. She gave the buildings, the land, and nearly all her furniture, and enough money, so she thought, to keep the college going forever. But there never is enough money, and now St. Anselm's has to be mainly financed by the church. I know that Father Sebastian and Father Martin are afraid that the church is planning to close it down. This fear is never openly discussed, and certainly not with the staff, though we all know. In a small and isolated community like St. Anselm's, news and gossip seem to be carried, unspoken, on the wind. Apart from giving the house, Miss Arbuthnot built the north and south cloisters at the back to provide rooms for the students, and a set of guest rooms linking the south cloister to the church. She also built four cottages for staff, arranged in a semicircle on the headland, about 100 yards from the college. She named them after the four evangelists. I am in St. Matthew, the most southerly. Ruby Pilbeam, who is the cook, housekeeper, and her husband, the general handyman, are in St. Mark. Mr. Gregory is in St. Luke, and in the northern cottage, St. John, is Eric Surtees, who helps Mr. Pilbeam. Eric keeps pigs, but more as a hobby than to provide pork for the college. There are just the four of us, with part-time cleaning women from Raiden and Lowestoft to help out, but there are never more than 20 ordinands and four resident priests, and we manage. None of us would be easy to replace. This windswept, desolate headland with no village, no pub, no shop, is too remote for most people. I like it here, but even I can find it frightening and a little sinister. The sea is eating away the sandy cliffs year by year, and sometimes I stand on the edge looking out to sea and can imagine a great tidal wave rearing up, white and glistening, racing towards the shore to crash over the turrets and towers, the church and the cottages, and wash us all away. The old village of Ballardsmere has been under the sea for centuries, and sometimes on windy nights folks say it's possible to hear the faint ringing of church bells from the buried towers. And what the sea didn't take was destroyed in a great fire in 1695. Nothing of the old village now remains, except the medieval church, which Miss Arbuthnot restored and made part of the college, and the two crumbling red brick pillars fronting the house, which are all that are left of the Elizabethan manor house that stood on the site. I'd better try to explain something about Ronald Treves, the boy who died. After all, his death is what this is supposed to be about. Before the inquest, the police questioned me, asking how well I'd known him. I suppose I knew him better than most of the staff here, but I didn't say much. There wasn't much I could tell. I didn't think it was my place to gossip about the students. I knew that he wasn't popular, but I didn't tell them that. The trouble was that he didn't really fit in, and I think he knew that he didn't. For one thing, his father was Sir Alred Treves, who runs an important armaments company, and Ronald liked us to know that he was the son of a very rich man. The things he owned showed it too. He had a Porsche, while the other students make do with cheaper cars, if they have a car at all. And he talked about his holidays in expensive and remote places that other students wouldn't be able to travel to, at least not in vacations. All that might have gained him popularity in some colleges, but not here. Everyone is snobbish about something. Don't let them tell you differently. But here, it isn't about money. It isn't really about family, either. Although you'd do better as the son of a curate than you would as the son of a pop star. I suppose what they really care about is cleverness. Cleverness and good looks and wit. They like people who can make them laugh. Ronald wasn't as clever as he thought he was, and he never made anyone laugh. They thought he was dull, and of course when he realized that, he became duller. I didn't say any of this to the police. What would have been the point? He was dead. Oh, and I think he was a bit of a snooper, too, always wanting to know what was going on, asking questions. He didn't get much out of me, but some evenings he would turn up at the cottage and sit and talk, while I knitted and listened. The students are discouraged from visiting the staff cottages, except by invitation. Father Sebastian likes us to have our privacy, but I didn't mind him, really. Looking back on it, I think he was lonely. Well, he wouldn't have bothered with me otherwise. And I remembered my Charlie. Charlie wasn't dull or unpopular or boring, but I like to think that if he'd ever been lonely and wanted to sit quietly and talk, there would have been someone like me to give him a welcome. When the police arrived, they asked me why I'd gone looking for him on the beach. But of course I hadn't. About twice a week, I take a solitary walk after I've had lunch, and when I set out, I didn't even realize that Ronald was missing. And I wouldn't have started looking on the beach. It's difficult to think what could happen to anyone on a deserted shore. It's safe enough if you don't clamber over the groynes or walk too close to the cliffs, and there are notices about the dangers of both. All the students are warned when they first arrive about the risk of swimming alone or walking too close to the unstable cliffs. In Miss Arbuthnot's time, it was possible to get down to the beach from the house, but the encroaching sea has changed all that. Now we have to walk about a half a mile south of the college to the only place where the cliffs are low and firm enough to support some half-dozen rickety wooden steps with a handrail. Beyond this point is the darkness of Ballardsmere, surrounded by trees and separated from the sea only by a narrow bank of shingle. Sometimes I walk as far as the mere and then turn back, but that day I went down the steps to the beach and started walking northward. After a night of rain, it was a fresh, lively day, the sky blue with scudding clouds, the tide running high. I rounded a slight promontory and saw the deserted beach stretching out before me with its narrow ridges of shingle and the dark lines of the old weed-encrusted groynes crumbling into the sea. And then, about 30 yards ahead, I saw what looked like a black bundle lying at the foot of the cliff. I hurried up to it and found a cassock, neatly folded, and beside it a brown cloak, also carefully folded. Within a few feet, the cliff had slithered and tumbled and now lay in great clumps of compacted sand, tufts of grass and stones. I knew at once what must have happened. I think I gave a little cry, and then I began scraping away at the sand. I knew a body must be buried underneath it, but it wasn't possible to know where. I remember the gritty sand under my nails, and how slow my progress seemed, so that I began kicking the sand with my feet as if in anger, spraying it high so that it stung my face and got into my eyes. Then I noticed a sharp-edged spar of wood about 30 yards towards the sea. I fetched it and used it to start probing. After a few minutes it struck something soft, and I knelt and began working again with my hands. Then I saw that what it had struck were two sand-encrusted buttocks, covered in fawn corduroy. After that I couldn't go on. My heart was pounding, and I had no more strength. I felt obscurely that I had humiliated whoever lay there, that there was something ridiculous and almost indecent about the two exposed mounds. I knew that he must be dead, and that all my feverish haste hadn't really been important. I couldn't have saved him, and now I couldn't bear to go on alone, uncovering him inch by inch, even if I'd had the strength. I had to get help, to break the news of what had happened. I think I knew even then whose body it was, but suddenly I remembered that all the ordnance brown cloaks have name tabs. I turned back the collar of the cloak and read the name. I remember stumbling down the beach on the firm edge of sand between the banks of pebbles and somehow dragging myself up the steps to the top of the cliff. I began running along the cliff road to the college. It was only a half mile, but the road seemed endless and the house seemed to recede with every painful step. My heart was beginning to pound, and my legs felt as if the bones were dissolving, and then I heard a car. Looking back, I saw it turning from the access road and coming towards me along the rough track bordering the cliff edge. I stood in the middle of the track and waved my arms, and the car slowed. I saw that it was Mr. Gregory. I can't remember how I broke the news. I have a picture of myself standing there, caked in sand, hair blowing in the wind, gesticulating towards the sea. He didn't say anything, but silently opened the car door and I got in. I suppose it would have been sensible to drive on to the college, but instead he turned the car and we got out at the steps to the beach. I've wondered since whether he didn't believe me and wanted to see for himself before calling for help. I can't remember the walk, and the last clear picture is of us standing together by Ronald's body. Still, without speaking, Mr. Gregory knelt in the sand and began digging with his hands. He was wearing leather gloves, and that made it easier for him. We both worked in silence, feverishly shifting the sand, working up to the top of the body. Above the corduroy trousers, Ronald was wearing only a grey shirt. We uncovered the back of his head. It was like uncovering an animal, a dead dog or a cat. The deeper sand was still moist, and his straw-colored hair was matted with it. I tried to brush it away, and it felt cold and gritty on my palms. Mr. Gregory said sharply, "Don't touch him," and I took my hand away quickly, as if it had been burned. Then he said very quietly, "We'd better leave him now, just as we found him. It's clear who it is." I knew that he was dead, but somehow I thought we ought to turn him over. I had some ridiculous idea that we could give him mouth-to-mouth breathing. I knew it wasn't rational, but I still felt we ought to do something. But Mr. Gregory took off his left glove and put two fingers against Ronald's neck. Then he said, "He's dead. But of course he's dead. There's nothing we can do for him." We were both silent for a moment, kneeling there on each side of him. We must have looked as if we were praying, and I would have said a prayer for him, only I couldn't think of the right words. And then the sun came out, and suddenly the scene looked as if it wasn't real, as if the two of us were being photographed in color. Everything was bright and clear-edged. The grains of sand on Ronald's hair shone like pinpoints of light. Mr. Gregory said, "We must get some help. Call the police. Do you mind waiting here with him? I won't be long. Or you can come with me if you prefer, but I think it would be better if one of us stayed." I said, "You go. You'll be quicker in the car. I don't mind waiting." I watched him as he walked as briskly as the shingle allowed towards the mere, then round the promontory and out of sight. A minute later I heard the sound of the car as he drove towards the college. I half slid down the sand a little way from the body and settled myself on the pebbles, wriggling to make myself more comfortable and digging in my heels. The pebbles beneath the surface were still damp from the night rain, and the cold wetness seeped through the cotton of my slacks. I sat with my arms folded round my knees, looking out over the sea. And sitting there, I thought of Mike for the first time in years. He was killed when his motorcycle skidded off the A1 and into a tree. We'd been home from our honeymoon for less than 2 weeks. We'd known each other for less than a year. What I felt at his death was shock and disbelief, not grief. I thought at the time that it was grief, but I know better now. I was in love with Mike, but I didn't love him. That comes with living together and caring for each other, and we never had the time. After he died, I knew that I was Margaret Munro, widow. But I felt that I was still Margaret Parker, spinster, age 21, a recently qualified nurse. When I discovered I was pregnant, that too seemed unreal. The baby, when he arrived, seemed nothing to do with Mike or our brief time together, and nothing to do with me. All that came later, and perhaps it was the stronger because it came late. When Charlie died, I mourned for both of them. But I still can't clearly recall Mike's face. I was aware of Ronald's body behind me, but it was a comfort not to be sitting at his side. Some people taking watch beside the dead find their presence companionable, but I didn't feel that. Not with Ronald. All I felt was a great sadness. It wasn't for that poor boy. It wasn't even for Charlie or Mike or for myself. It was a universal sadness which seemed to permeate everything round me. The fresh breeze against my cheek, the sky where there were a few massed clouds moving almost deliberately, it seemed, across the blue, and the sea itself. I found myself thinking of all the people who'd lived and died on this coast, and of the bones lying a mile out under the waves in the great churchyards. Their lives must have mattered at the time to themselves and the people who cared about them, but now they were dead, and it would have been just the same as if they'd never lived. In 100 years, no one will remember Charlie, Mike, or me. All our lives are as insignificant as a single grain of sand. My mind felt emptied, even of sadness. Instead, gazing out to sea, accepting that in the end nothing really matters, and that all we have is the present moment to endure or enjoy, I felt at peace. I suppose I was sitting in a kind of trance, because I didn't see or hear the three approaching figures until there was the loud crunch of shingle, and they'd almost reached me. Father Sebastian and Mr. Gregory were trudging side by side. Father Sebastian had wrapped his black cloak tightly round him against the wind. Both their heads were bent, and they walked purposefully, as if they were marching. Father Martin was a little way behind, lurching as he struggled with difficulty over the shingle. I remember thinking that it was unkind of the other two not to wait for him. I felt embarrassed to be discovered sitting. I got up, and Father Sebastian said, "Are you all right, Margaret?" I said, "Yes, Father," and then stood aside as the three of them walked up to the body. Father Sebastian made the sign of the cross, then said, "This is a disaster." Even at the time, I thought it was a strange word to use, and I knew that he wasn't just thinking at that moment of Ronald Treves. He was thinking of the college. He bent down and put his hand against the back of Ronald's neck, and Mr. Gregory said, quite sharply, "He's dead, of course. Better not disturb the body any further." Father Martin was standing a little apart. I saw his lips moving, and I think he was praying. Father Sebastian said, "If you, Gregory, will go back to the college and watch for the police, Father Martin and I will stay here. Margaret had better go with you. This has been a shock for her. Take her to Mrs. Pilbeam, if you will, and explain what's happened. Mrs. Pilbeam will make her some hot tea and look after her. Neither of them are to say anything until I inform the college. If the police want to talk to Margaret, they can do so later." It's funny, but I remember feeling a slight sense of resentment that he'd spoken to Mr. Gregory, almost as if I wasn't there. And I didn't really want to be taken to Ruby Pilbeam's cottage. I like Ruby, who's always managed to be kind without being interfering, but all I wanted was to go home. Father Sebastian came up and laid a hand on my shoulder. He said, "You've been very brave, Margaret. Thank you. Go with Mr. Gregory now, and I'll come to see you later. Father Martin and I will sit here with Ronald." It was the first time he had spoken the boy's name. In the car, Mr. Gregory drove for a few minutes in silence, then said, "That's a curious death. I wonder what the coroner, or, come to that, the police, will make of it." I said, "Surely it was an accident." "A curious accident, wouldn't you say?" I didn't reply. Then he said, "This isn't the first dead body you've seen, of course. You'll be accustomed to death." "I'm a nurse, Mr. Gregory." I thought of the first body I'd seen, all those years ago, as an 18-year-old probationer, the first body I'd laid out. Nursing was different in those days. We used to lay out the dead ourselves, and it was done with great reverence and in silence behind the screens. My first ward sister used to join us to say a prayer before we began. She told us that this was the last service we could render our patients. But I wasn't going to talk to Mr. Gregory about that. He said, "Seeing a dead body, anybody, is a comforting reassurance that we may live as men, but we die as animals. Personally, I find that a relief. I can't imagine any greater horror than eternal life." I still didn't reply. It's not that I dislike him. We hardly ever meet. Ruby Pilbeam cleans his cottage once a week and does his washing. It's a private arrangement they have, but he and I have never been on chatting terms, and I wasn't in the mood to begin now. The car turned westward between the twin towers and into the courtyard. Releasing his seat belt and helping me with mine, he said, "I'll walk with you to Mrs. Pilbeam's. She may not be in. If not, you'd better come to my cottage. What we both need is a drink." But she was in, and I was glad of it after all. Mr. Gregory reported the facts very briefly and said, "Father Sebastian and Father Martin are with the body now, and the police will arrive very soon. Please don't mention this to anyone else until Father Sebastian returns. He'll then speak to the whole college." After he had gone, Ruby did indeed make tea, hot and strong and very comforting. She fussed over me, but I can't remember the words or the gestures. I didn't say much, but she didn't expect me to. She treated me as if I were ill, settling me in one of the easy chairs before the fireplace, switching on 2 bars of the electric fire in case I felt cold with shock, and then drawing the curtains so that I could have what she described as a good long rest. I suppose it was about an hour before the police arrived. A youngish sergeant with a Welsh accent. He was kind and patient, and I answered his questions quite calmly. There wasn't, after all, very much to tell. He asked me how well I'd known Ronald, the last time I'd seen him, and whether he'd been depressed lately. I said I'd last seen him the previous evening, walking towards Mr. Gregory's cottage, I suppose, for his Greek lesson. Term had only just started, and that's all I'd seen of him. I got the impression that the police sergeant, I think his name was Jones or Evans, a Welsh name anyway, was sorry he had asked the question about Ronald being depressed. Anyway, he said that it all looked quite straightforward, asked Ruby the same questions, and then left. Father Sebastian broke the news of Ronald's death to the whole college when they assembled before 5 o'clock evensong. Most of the ordinance had guessed by then that something tragic had happened. Police cars and a mortuary van don't arrive in secret. I didn't go to the library, so I never heard what Father Sebastian said. All I wanted by then was to be alone. But later in the evening, the senior student, Raphael Arbuthnot, brought me a small pot of blue African violets with the sympathy of all the ordinance. One of them must have driven into Pakefield or Lowestoft to buy them. When he gave them to me, Raphael bent down and kissed my cheek. He said, "I'm so sorry, Margaret." It was the kind of thing people say at a time like that, but it didn't sound commonplace. What it sounded like was an apology. It was 2 nights later that the nightmares began. I have never suffered from nightmares before, not even when I was a student nurse and first encountered death. The dreams are horrible, and now I sit in front of the television until late every evening, dreading the moment when tiredness drives me to bed. The dream is always the same. Ronald Treves is standing beside the bed. He is naked, and his body is plastered with damp sand. It is matted in his fair hair and over his face. Only the eyes are free of sand, and they gaze at me reproachfully, as if asking why I didn't do more to save him. I know that there was nothing I could have done. I know that he was dead long before I came upon his body, but still he appears, night after night, with that accusing, reproachful gaze, the damp sand falling in clumps from his plain, rather pudgy face. Perhaps now that I've written it down, he will leave me in peace. I don't think I am a fanciful woman, but there is something strange about his death, something I ought to remember, but which lies nagging at the back of my mind. Something tells me that Ronald Treves's death wasn't an end, but a beginning. 2. The call to Dalgleish came at 10:40 a.m., just before he returned to his office after a meeting with the Community Relations Branch. It had gone on later than scheduled. Such meetings invariably did. And there were only 50 minutes before he was due to join the Commissioner in the Home Secretary's office of the House of Commons. Time, he thought, for a coffee, and to make a couple of outstanding telephone calls. But he had hardly reached his desk when his PA put her head round the office door. "Mr. Harkness would be grateful if you would see him before you leave. He's got Sir Alred Treves with him." So now what? Sir Alred wanted something, of course. People who came to see senior officers of the Yard usually did, and what Sir Alred wanted, he invariably got. You didn't run one of the most prosperous multinational corporations without knowing instinctively how to control the intricacies of power in small matters as in large. Dalgleish knew of his reputation. You could hardly live in the 21st century and be ignorant of it. A fair, even generous employer of successful staff, a liberal supporter of charities from his trust funds, a respected collector of 20th century European art, all of which could be translated by the prejudiced as a ruthless pruner of failures, a well-advertised supporter of fashionable causes, and an investor with an eye for long-term capital gain. Even his reputation for rudeness was ambiguous. Since it was indiscriminate, and the powerful suffered with the weak, it had merely gained him an admirable reputation for honest egalitarianism. Dalgleish took the lift to the 7th floor with little expectation of pleasure, but considerable curiosity. At least the meeting would be relatively short. He would have to leave by 15:15 to walk that convenient half-mile to the Home Office. When it came to priorities, the Home Secretary took precedence over even Sir Alred Treves. The Assistant Commissioner and Sir Alred were standing by Harkness's desk, and both turned to face Dalgleish as he entered. As often with people who feature prominently in the media, the first impression of Treves was disconcerting. He was stockier and less ruggedly handsome than he appeared on television, the facial contour less defined. But the impression of latent power and a certain self-conscious enjoyment of it was even stronger. It was his foibled dress as a prosperous farmer, except on the most formal occasions he wore well-tailored tweeds. There was indeed something of the countryman about his person, the broad shoulders, the burnish on the cheeks and over the prominent nose, the unruly hair that no barber could entirely discipline. It was very dark, almost black, with a silver streak swept back from the middle of the forehead. In a man more concerned with his appearance, Dalgleish could have suspected that it had been dyed. As Dalgleish entered, Treves' glance under his bushy eyebrows was direct and frankly appraising. Harkness said, "I think you know each other." They shook hands. Sir Alred's hand was cold and strong, but he withdrew it at once, as if to emphasize that the gesture had been a formality. He said, "We have met. A Home Office conference in the late 80s, wasn't it? On policy in the inner cities, I don't know why I got mixed up in it. Your corporation made a generous donation to one of the schemes organized under the Inner Cities Initiatives. I think you wanted to satisfy yourself that it was likely to be usefully spent." "I dare say. Not much chance of that. Young people want well-paid jobs worth getting up in the morning for, not training for work that doesn't exist." Dalgleish recalled the occasion. It had been the usual highly organized public relations exercise. Few of the senior officers or ministers present had expected much to come of it, and little had. Treves, he remembered, had asked a number of pertinent questions, had expressed skepticism at the answers and had left before the minister's summing up. Why exactly had he chosen to attend, chosen indeed to contribute? Perhaps that, too, had been a public relations exercise. Harkness made a vague gesture towards the black swivel chairs ranged in front of the window and murmured something about coffee. Treve said curtly, "No, thank you. I won't take coffee." His tone implied that he had been offered an esoteric beverage inappropriate to 10:45 in the morning. They seated themselves with something of the portentous wariness of three mafia bosses meeting to settle their several spheres of interest. Treves looked at his watch. Specific time had no doubt been allowed for this encounter. He had come at his own convenience with no prior notice and no forewarning of what he had in mind. That, of course, had given him the advantage. He had arrived with every confidence that a senior officer would find time for him, and he had been right. "Now," he said, "my elder son Ronald, he was adopted, by the way, was killed 10 days ago in a cliff fall in Suffolk. Sand fall would be a more accurate description. Those cliffs south of Lowestoft have been eaten away by the sea since the 17th century. He was suffocated. Ronald was a student at St. Anselm's Theological College at Ballardsmuir. It's a high church establishment for the training of Anglican priests. Smells and bells." He turned to Dalgleish. "You know about this sort of thing, don't you? Wasn't your father a parson?" And how, Dalgleish wondered, did Sir Alred know that? Probably at some time he'd been told it, half recalled the fact and asked one of his minions to check before setting out for this meeting. He was a man who believed in having as much information as possible about the people with whom he was to deal. If it was to their discredit, so much the better. But any personal detail that the other party didn't know he possessed was a satisfying and potentially useful accession of power. Dalgleish said, "He was a Norfolk rector, yes." Harkness asked, "Your son was training for the ministry?" "I'm not aware that what he was being taught at St. Anselm's would have qualified him for any other job." Dalgleish said, "There was a mention of the death in the broadsheets, but I don't remember reading about the inquest." "You wouldn't. It was kept pretty quiet. Accidental death. It should have been an open verdict. If the warden of the college and most of the staff hadn't been sitting there like a row of black-gowned vigilantes, the coroner would probably have found the courage to return a proper verdict." "You were there, Sir Alred?"
"No. I was represented, but I was in China. There was a complicated contract to be negotiated in Beijing. I came back for the cremation. We brought the body back to London for that. They had some kind of memorial service, a requiem, I think they called it, at St. Anselm's, but neither my wife nor I attended. It's not a place where I ever felt at home. Immediately after the inquest, I arranged for my chauffeur with another driver to collect Ronald's Porsche, and the college handed over his clothes, his wallet, and his watch. Norris, he's my driver, brought back the parcel, but there wasn't much. The students aren't encouraged to have more than the minimum of clothes, a suit, two pairs of jeans with the usual shirts and pullovers, shoes, and that black cassock which the students are required to wear. He had some books, of course, but I told the college that they could have those for the library. It's odd how quickly you can tidy away a life. Then 2 days ago I received this." Unhurriedly, he took out his wallet and unfolded a sheet of paper, then passed it to Dalgleish. Dalgleish glanced at it and handed it to the assistant commissioner. Harkness read it aloud. "Why don't you ask some questions about your son's death? Nobody really believes it was an accident. Those priests will cover up anything to keep their good name. There are a number of things going on in that college which ought to be brought into the light. Are you going to let them get away with it?" Treve said, "I regard that as coming close to an accusation of murder." Harkness handed the paper to Dalgleish. He said, "But without evidence, with no motive alleged and no suspect named, isn't it as likely to be the work of some prankster, perhaps someone who wants to make trouble for the college?" Dalgleish handed the paper back to Treves, but it was waved away impatiently. Treves said, "Obviously it's a possibility, among others. I imagine you won't rule that out. Personally, I take a more serious view. Produced on a computer, of course. So no chance of that usual little E out of alignment, which always crops up in crime fiction. You needn't trouble to test for fingerprints. I've had that done. Confidentially, of course. No result, but I didn't expect one. And the writer is educated, I'd say. He or she has got the punctuation right. In this under-educated age, I'd suggest that means someone middle-aged rather than young. Dalgleish said. And written in a way likely to spur you into action. Why do you say that? You're here, sir, aren't you? Harkness asked. You said that your son was adopted. What was his background? He had none. His mother was 14 when he was born, his father a year older. He was conceived against a concrete pillar in the Westway underpass. He was white, healthy, and newborn, a desirable commodity in the adoption market. To put it bluntly, we were lucky to get him. Why the question? You said that you were taking this as an accusation of murder. I was wondering who, if anyone, would benefit from his death. Every death benefits someone. The only beneficiary here is my second son, Marcus, whose trust fund, when he reaches 30, will now be augmented, and his eventual inheritance greater than it might otherwise have been. As he was at school at the relevant time, we can exclude him. Ronald hadn't written or spoken to you about being depressed or unhappy. Not to me. But then I'm probably the last person he would have confided in. But I don't think we're understanding each other. I'm not here to be interrogated or to take part in your investigation. I've told you the little I know. Now I want you to take it over. Harkness glanced at Dalgleish. He said, It's a matter, of course, for the Suffolk police. They're an efficient force. I've no doubt they are. Presumably they get inspected by Her Majesty's Inspector of Constabulary and certified as efficient, but they were part of the original inquiry. I want you to take it over specifically. I want Commander Dalgleish to take it over. The Assistant Commissioner looked at Dalgleish and seemed about to protest, then thought better of it. Dalgleish said, I'm due to take some leave next week, and I plan to be in Suffolk for about a week. I know St. Anselm's. I could have a word with the local police and with people at the college and see if there is a prima facie case for taking the matter further. But with the inquest verdict and your son's body cremated, it's highly unlikely that anything new will come to light now. Harkness found his voice. It's unorthodox. Treves got to his feet. It may be unorthodox, but it seems to me perfectly sensible. I want discretion. That's why I don't intend to go back to the local people. There was enough fuss in the local papers when the news of his death broke. I don't want headlines in the tabloids suggesting there was something mysterious about the death. Harkness said, But you think there was? Of course there was. Ronald's death was either an accident, suicide, or murder. The first is improbable, the second inexplicable, which leaves the third. You'll get in touch with me, of course, when you've reached a conclusion. He was rising from his chair when Harkness asked, Were you happy, Sir Alred, about your son's choice of career? He paused, then added, Job, vocation, whatever. Something in his tone, an uneasy compromise between tact and interrogation, made it apparent that he hadn't expected his question to be well received. And it wasn't. Sir Alred's voice was quiet, but held an unmistakable warning. What precisely is that supposed to mean? Having started, Harkness had no intention of being intimidated. I was wondering whether your son had anything on his mind, a particular cause of worry. Sir Alred deliberately glanced at his wristwatch. He said, You're suggesting suicide. I thought I'd made my position clear. That's out. Out. Why the hell should he kill himself? He'd got what he wanted. Dalgleish said quietly, But if it wasn't what you wanted? Of course it wasn't what I wanted. A job with no future. The C of E will be defunct in 20 years if the present decline continues, or it'll be an eccentric sect concerned with maintaining old superstitions and ancient churches. That is, if the state hasn't taken them over as national monuments. People might want the illusion of spirituality. No doubt, by and large, they believe in God, and the thought that death might be extinction isn't agreeable. But they've stopped believing in heaven, and they're not afraid of hell. And they won't start going to church. Ronald had education. intelligence, opportunities. He wasn't stupid. He could have made something of his life. He knew what I felt, and the matter was closed between us. He certainly wasn't going to stick his head under a ton of sand to disoblige me. He got to his feet and nodded briefly to Harkness and Dalgleish. The interview was over. Dalgleish went down in the lift with him and then walked with him to where the chauffeur-driven Mercedes had glided to a stop. The timing, as he had expected, was perfect. He had turned away when he was peremptorily called back. Thrusting his head out of the window, Sir Alred said, "It's occurred to you, I imagine, that Ronald could have been killed elsewhere and his body moved to the beach?" "I think you can assume, Sir Alred, that it will have occurred to the Suffolk police." "I'm not sure I share your confidence. It's a thought, anyway, worth bearing in mind." He made no move to order his chauffeur, sitting immobile and expressionless as a statue at the wheel, to drive off. Instead, he said, as if on impulse, "Now here's a matter that intrigues me. It occurred to me in church, actually. I show my face from time to time, the annual city service, you know. I thought that when I had a spare moment, I'd follow it up. It's about the creed." Dalgleish was adept at concealing surprise. He asked gravely, "Which one, Sir Alred? Is there more than one?" "Three, actually." "Good God! Well, take any one. They're much the same, I suppose. How did they start? I mean, who wrote them?" Dalgleish, intrigued, was tempted to ask whether Sir Alred had discussed his question with his son, but prudence prevailed. He said, "I think a theologian would be more useful to you than I am, Sir Alred." "You're a parson's son, aren't you? I thought you'd know. I haven't the time to go asking around." Dalgleish's mind spun back to his father's study at the Norfolk Rectory, to facts either learned or picked up from browsing in his father's library, to words he seldom spoke now but which seemed to have lodged in his mind since childhood. He said, "The Nicene Creed was formulated by the Council of Nicaea in the 4th century. The date inexplicably came to mind. I think it was 325. The Emperor Constantine called the council to settle the belief of the church and deal with the Arian heresy." "Why doesn't the church bring it up to date? We don't look to the 4th century for our understanding of medicine or science or the nature of the universe. I don't look to the 4th century when I run my companies. Why look to 325 for our understanding of God?" Dalgleish said, "You'd prefer a creed for the 21st century. He was tempted to ask whether Sir Alred had it in mind to write one. Instead, he said, "I doubt whether any new council, in a divided Christendom, would arrive at a consensus. The church, no doubt, takes the view that the bishops at Nicaea were divinely inspired." "It was a council of men, wasn't it? Powerful men. They brought to it their private agendas, their prejudices, their rivalries. Essentially, it was about power. Who gets it? Who yields it? You've sat on enough committees, you know how they work. Ever known one that was divinely inspired?" Dalgleish said, "Not home office working parties, admittedly." He added, "Are you thinking of writing to the Archbishop, or perhaps the Pope?" Sir Alred gave him a sharp, suspicious look, but apparently decided that if he were being teased, he would ignore or collude in it. He said, "Too busy. Anyway, it's a bit outside my province. Still, it's interesting. You'd think that it would have occurred to them. You'll let me know if anything turns up at St. Anselm's. I'll be out of the country for the next 10 days, but there's no hurry. If the boy was murdered, I shall know what to do. If he killed himself, well, that's his business, but I'd like to know that too." He nodded and abruptly withdrew his head. He said to the driver, "All right, Norris, back to the office." The car glided away. Dalgleish stared after it for a moment. With Alred, what you saw was what you got. Hadn't that been an overconfident and even presumptuous assessment? The man was more complex than that. In his mixture of naivete and subtlety, of arrogance and that far-ranging curiosity which, alighting incongruously on a subject, invested it immediately with the dignity of his personal interest. But Dalgleish was still puzzled. The verdict on Ronald Treves, even if surprising, had at least been merciful. Was there some other, more intriguing reason than parental concern for his insistence on a further inquiry?
He returned to the seventh floor. Harkness was staring out of the window. Without turning, he said,
"An extraordinary man. Had he anything else to say?"
"He'd like to rewrite the Nicene Creed."
"The idea's absurd."
"But probably less harmful to the human race than most of his other activities."
"I meant this proposal to waste the time of a senior officer reopening the inquiry to his son's death."
"Still,
he's not going to let it rest. Will you set it up with Suffolk, or shall I?"
"Better keep it as low-key as possible. Peter Jackson transferred there last year as AC. I'll have a word with him. And I know something of St. Anselm's. I stayed there as a boy for 3 summers. I don't suppose any of the same staff are there, but they'll probably see my arrival as more or less natural in the circumstances."
"Do you think so?"
"They may live remote from the world, but I doubt they'll be that naive. A commander of the Met taking an interest in the accidental death of a student."
"Well, we haven't much choice. Treves isn't going to let this go, and we can hardly send a couple of sergeants to start nosing about on someone else's patch. But if it is a suspicious death, Suffolk will have to take over whether Treves likes it or not. And he can give over thinking that they can mount a murder investigation in secret. There's this to be said for murder. Once it's out in the open, we all stand on equal ground. That's one thing even Treves can't manipulate to suit his convenience. It's odd, though, isn't it? I mean, it's odd, his bothering, making a personal matter of it. If he wants to keep it out of the press, why resurrect it? And why take the letter seriously? He must get his share of letters from lunatics. You'd expect him to chuck this away with the rest of the rubbish."
Dalgleish was silent. Whatever the motive of the sender, the message hadn't struck him as the work of someone deranged. Harkness moved closer to the window and stood, shoulders hunched, peering out as if the familiar panorama of towers and spires had suddenly become interestingly strange to him. Without turning, he said, "He didn't show any pity for the boy, did he? And it can't have been easy for him. The kid, I mean. He gets adopted, presumably because Treves and his wife thought they couldn't have children, and then she gets pregnant and a proper son arrives. The genuine article, your own flesh and blood, not a kid chosen for you by the social services department. And it isn't unusual. I know a case. The adopted child always feels that he's in the family under false pretenses." The words had been spoken with barely controlled vehemence. There was a moment's silence. Then Dalgleish said, "That may account for it." "That, or guilt. He couldn't love the boy when he was alive. Can't even grieve for him now he's dead. But he can see that he gets justice." Harkness turned and said brusquely,
"What use is justice to the dead? Better to concentrate on justice for the living. But you're probably right. Anyway, do what you can. I'll put the commissioner in the picture."
He and Dalgleish had been on Christian name terms for 8 years, yet he spoke as if he were dismissing a sergeant.
3.
The file for the meeting with the Home Secretary was ready on his desk, with the annexes tabbed. His PA, as always, had been efficient. As he put the papers in his briefcase and went down in the lift, Dalgleish freed his mind from the preoccupations of the day and let it range free on the windswept coast of Ballardsmere. So he was going back at last. Why, he wondered, hadn't he returned before? His aunt had lived on the coast of East Anglia, at first in her cottage and then in the converted mill, and on his visits he could easily have made the journey to St. Anselm's. Had it been an instinctive reluctance to court disappointment? The knowledge that one returns to a well-loved place always under judgment, burdened by the sad accretion of the years. And he would return as a stranger. Father Martin had been on the staff when he last visited, but he must have retired long ago. He would be 80 by now. He would bring to St. Anselm's only unshared memories. And he would come uninvited and as a police officer to reopen with little justification a case that must have caused the staff of St. Anselm's distress and embarrassment, and which they had hoped to put behind them. But now he was returning, and he found that the prospect was suddenly pleasant. He walked, unheeding the undistinguished bureaucratic half-mile between Broadway and Parliament Square. But his mind inhabited a quieter, less frenetic scene. The sandy, friable cliffs spilling onto a beach pitted with rain. The oak groins, half-demolished by centuries of tides, but still withstanding the sea's onslaughts. The grit road, which had once run a mile inland, but was now perilously close to the cliff edge. And St. Anselm's itself. The two crumbling Tudor towers flanking the front courtyard, the iron-bounded oak door, and, to the rear of the great brick and stone Victorian mansion, the delicate cloisters enclosing the west court. The northerly one leading directly to the medieval church which serves the community as its chapel. He remembered that the students had worn cassocks when they were in college, and brown and worsted cloaks with hoods as a protection against the wind, never absent from that coast. He saw them, now surpliced for evensong, filing into the church stalls, smelled the incense-scented air, saw the altar, with more candles than his Anglican father would have thought proper, and above the altar the framed painting by Roger van der Weyden of the Holy Family. Would that still be there? And was that other possession, more secret, more mysterious, and more jealously guarded, still hidden in the college? The Anselm Papyrus? He had spent only 3 summer holidays at the college. His father had exchanged ministries with a priest from a difficult inner-city parish to give him at least a change of scene and tempo. Dalgleish's parents had been unwilling to immure him in an industrial city for most of the summer holiday, and he had been invited to stay on at the rectory with the newcomers. But the news that the Reverend Cuthbert Simpson and his wife had 4 children under the age of 8, including 7-year-old twins, had turned him against the idea. Even at 14, he had longed for privacy during the long holiday. So he had agreed to accept an invitation from the warden at St. Anselm's, while being uneasily aware that his mother thought he would have shown a more generous spirit by offering to stay and help with the twins. The college had been half empty, with only a few overseas students choosing to remain. They and the priests had taken trouble to make his stay happy, setting up a wicket on the stretch of specially mown grass behind the church and bowling to him indefatigably. He remembered that the food had been greatly superior to school meals and, indeed, to those at the rectory, and he had liked his guest room even though it gave no view of the sea. But he had most enjoyed the solitary walks, south towards the mere or north towards Lowestoft, the freedom to use the library, the prevailing but never oppressive silence, the assurance that he could take possession of every new day in unquestioned liberty. And then, during his second visit and on the 3rd of August, there had been Sadie. Father Martin had said, "Mrs. Milson's granddaughter is coming to stay with her in her cottage. She's about your age, I think, Adam. It might be company for you." Mrs. Milson had been the cook, even then in her 60s, and certainly long since retired. And Sadie had been company of a sort. She was a thin 15-year-old with fine corn-coloured hair which hung down each side of a narrow face, and small eyes of a remarkable grey flecked with green, which on their first meeting stared at him with resentful intensity. But she seemed happy enough to walk with him, seldom speaking, occasionally picking up a stone to hurl into the sea, or suddenly spurting ahead with fierce determination, then turning to wait for him, rather like a puppy chasing after a ball. He remembered one day after a storm, when the sky had cleared, but the wind was still high and great waves were crashing in with as much vehemence as they had during the dark hours of the night. They had sat side by side in the shelter of a groin, passing a bottle of lemonade from mouth to mouth. He had written her a poem. More, he remembered, an exercise in trying to imitate Eliot, his most recent enthusiasm, than a tribute to genuine feeling. She had read it with furrowed brow, the small eyes almost invisible. "You wrote this?" "Yes. It's for you. A poem." "No, it isn't. It doesn't rhyme. A boy in our class, Billy Price, writes poems. They always rhyme." He said indignantly, "It's a different kind of poem." "No, it isn't. If it's a poem, the words at the end of the lines have to rhyme. Billy Price says so."
Later, he had come to believe that Billy Price had a point. He got up, tore the paper into small pieces and dropped them on the wet sand, watching and waiting for the next tumbling wave to suck them into oblivion. So much, he thought, for poetry's famed erotic power. But Sadie's female mind, in achieving its elemental ends, operated a less sophisticated, more atavistic ploy. She said, "Bet you daren't dive off the end of that groin." Billy Price, he thought, would no doubt have dared to dive off the end of the groin in addition to writing verse which rhymed at the end of each line. Without speaking, he got up and tore off his shirt. Wearing only his khaki shorts, he balanced on the groin, paused, walked over a slither of seaweed to the end and dived headlong into the turbulent sea. It was less deep than he thought, and he felt the scrape of pebbles rasping his palms before he surfaced. Even in August, the North Sea was cold, but the shock of the chill was only temporary. What followed was terrifying. It felt as if he were in the grasp of some uncontrollable force, as if strong hands were seizing him by the shoulders and forcing him backwards and under. Spluttering, he tried to strike out, but the shore was suddenly obliterated by a great wall of water. It crashed over him, and he felt himself drawn back, then tossed upwards into daylight. He struck out towards the groin, which seemed with every second to be receding. He could see Sadie standing now on the edge, arms flailing, her hair streaming in the wind. She was shouting something, but he could hear nothing but the drumming in his ears. He gathered his strength, waiting for the wave to advance, making progress, then desperately trying to hold on to it before the backward tug lost the few feet he had gained. He told himself not to panic, to husband strength, to try and catch each forward movement. And at last, foot by painful foot, he made it and, gasping, clutched the end of the groin. It was minutes before he was able to move, but she reached down her hand and helped pull him up. They sat side by side on a ridge of pebbles and, without speaking, she took off her dress and began rubbing his back. When he was dry, still without speaking, she handed him his shirt. He remembered now that the sight of her body, of the small pointed breasts and the pink and tender nipples, had aroused not desire, but an emotion that he now recognized as a mixture of affection and pity. Then she said, "Do you want to go to the mere? I know a secret place." The mere would still be there. A stretch of dark, still water separated from the lively sea by a bank of shingle, its oily surface hinting at unfathomable depths. Except in the worst storms, the stagnant mere and salt sea never met across that shifting barrier. At the edge of the tide, the trunks of black fossilized trees stood like totem poles to some long-dead civilization. The mere was a famous haunt of seabirds, and there were wooden hides concealed among the trees and bushes, but only the most enthusiastic birdwatcher ever penetrated to this dark and sinister stretch of water. Sadie's secret place had been the wooden hulk of a wrecked ship, half embedded in the sand on the spit of land between the sea and the mere. There were still a few rotting steps down to the cabin, and there they'd spent the rest of the afternoon and all the days that followed. The only light had come from slits in the planking, and they had laughed to see how their bodies were striped, tracing the moving lines with their fingers. He would read or write or sit back silently against the curved wall of the cabin, while Sadie imposed on their small world her ordered, if eccentric, domesticity. The picnics provided by her grandmother were carefully laid out on flat stones, the food to be ceremoniously handed to him and eaten when she decreed. Jam jars filled with water from the mere held reeds and grasses and unidentified rubber-leaved plants from fissures in the cliff. Together they scoured the beach for stones with holes to add to the necklace that she had strung on cord along the cabin wall. For years after that summer, the smell of tar, of warm rotting oak, combined with the tang of the sea, had held for him an erotic charge. Where, he wondered, was Sadie now? Probably married with a brood of golden-haired children. If their fathers hadn't been drowned, electrocuted or otherwise disposed of in Sadie's preliminary process of selection. It was unlikely that any trace of the wreck would remain. After decades of pounding, the sea must now have claimed its prey. And long before the final plank was tossed into the advancing tide, the string of the necklace would have frayed and, at last, finally broken, letting slip those carefully gathered stones to fall in a heap on the sand of the cabin floor.
4. It was Thursday, 12 October, and Margaret Munro was writing the final entry in the diary. Looking back over this diary since I began writing it, most of it seems so dull that I wonder why I persevere. The entries following Ronald Treves' death have been little more than descriptions of my daily routine, interposed with descriptions of the weather. After the inquest and the Requiem Mass, it sometimes seemed as if the tragedy had been formally tidied away and he had never been here. None of the students speak of him, at least not to me, and nor do the priests. His body was never returned to St. Anselm's, even for the Requiem. Sir Alred wanted it to be cremated in London, so it was removed after the inquest by London undertakers. Father John packed up his clothes, and Sir Alred sent two men in a car to collect the bundle and drive back Ronald's Porsche. The bad dreams have begun to fade, and I no longer wake up sweating, imagining that sand-caked, blind-eyed horror groping towards me. But Father Martin was right. It has helped me, writing down all the details, and I shall go on writing. I find I look forward to that moment at the end of the day when I've tidied away my supper things and can sit down at the table with this notebook. I haven't any other talent, but I do enjoy using words, thinking about the past, trying to stand outside the things that have happened to me and make sense of them. But today's entry won't be dull or routine. Yesterday was different. Something important did happen, and I need to write it down to make the account complete. But I don't know whether it would be right even to form the words. It isn't my secret, after all, and although no one will ever read this account but me, I can't help feeling that there are things which it's unwise to put down on paper. When secrets are unspoken and unwritten, they are lodged safely in the mind.